lofty debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand, we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. Shall we what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America. North to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People. We are a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to educate Americans and people around the world about the cost of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. And implicit in that is the idea that we really need to have a democracy if we're going to make America work for the 99%, not just the 1%. So I am very pleased to have come across somebody who's done a lot of thinking about this. Our guest today, Greg Wasson, is the Executive Secretary of the Committee for Petition Rights. He's an attorney, not practicing currently. Prior to that, he was a journalist writing on legal issues, and subsequent to practicing, he was a blogger for a while, also talking about legal issues, and in particular, issues of constitutional law, which he's become an expert at. And his interest is in making government more representative. Now, before we get talking about how we can have a better representative democracy, let's define a few terms here. Now, he provided me with a nice little summary paper of the kind of work he's doing. It has the quote in it, "The founding fathers stood for government with the consent of the governed, not by the governed." Now, that clearly is not democracy, and you could argue whether or not it's representative democracy, but I think it's a nice definition of representative democracy in my mind. It just means that we elect representatives. That means that we give consent for them to make the decisions. So it's not that these decisions are not made directly by us. Is that correct, Greg? And welcome to the show, by the way. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, my idea of a democratic republic is just not our representatives being exclusive lawmakers. That, you know, that's why we have the initiative system. Because, I mean, just think about it. The only way to keep somebody honest is if there's somebody on the outside watching them. That's just how it works. And the right to vote, I mean, come on. Anybody who thinks the right to vote is sufficient just hasn't been paying attention.
So what you're saying is you can't really have a representative democracy just by having the right to vote. There are a lot of things that, that make that or can make that non-representative, like the idea that the people don't really choose who they get to vote for. That's one of the issues. And you get into that in detail in your paper here. Let's just talk about a number of ways that we're not representative. That's how you actually lead off the paper. What's wrong with the Constitution? What makes it unrepresentative of the people?
Well, the federal Constitution, originally under the federal Constitution, the various state legislatures selected the federal Senate, not the people. So since we only had 60 people in Salem who appointed Oregon senator, that was only 60 people that you had to bribe. So if you were an East Coast corporation who wanted to make sure that you had the right people in the U.S. Senate, you would come to Oregon. People would run for office just so they would have a vote to sell. And then every 6 years, the bankers and the whores would get together down at the Marion Hotel, and we'd choose our new U.S. senator. And, I mean, Oregon wasn't alone. That's how it worked all around the country.
Right, and one of the important points to get out of that is that it is a lot cheaper to buy off the Senate, or excuse me, it's a lot more cost-effective to buy off the senators in small states because they have the same votes as people in large states. So you can get a very tiny proportion of the population to control the Senate, at least now. That was
well, and of course, you know, I mean, there is a line of thought that says the reason for the Constitution, at least on the federal level, is not to allow for positive things, but to keep the inevitable concentration of power from happening.
Right, that's what we're taught in school.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that, you know, Barry Goldwater, that was one of Barry Goldwater's big things. And, you know, I believe that, I mean, because just whenever power gets together, a centralized authority, once created, strives to become absolute. That's just how it works, right?
Well, that certainly seems to be the history, and that, I think, is what Washington meant when he said he didn't want to see factions contending for power because the federal government is supposed to represent all the people.
Yeah, well, you know, but I mean, just think about it. If I make something, what is the best way to ensure my success but to have Congress pass a law saying everybody has to buy it?
Right, so you're talking about the power of private individuals. I thought you were talking about the power of politicians. Sure.
And also you have to realize that this country isn't run by Congress. This country is run by the people who own Congress.
Right. That is the point of this show is corporate control of Congress. I say, but of course there's individuals who control those corporations too. So,
well, yeah, but I mean, and America has been corporate centric since before the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the, you know, the Declaration of Independence, we the people, all men created equal, that's a great slogan. Those are great slogans to get farm boys to go sacrifice their lives.
Right.
But it's a dangerous way to have a government. So the Declaration of Independence, which people always quote, is great. I mean, it's a great document. But the Constitution is not the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
And when you go into court, if you start quoting the Declaration of Independence, the judge is going to throw you out. And the Constitution is a whole lot different.
Exactly. And I want to come back in a bit to the statement you made that it's dangerous to incorporate the idea that all men are created equal into the Constitution. We will come back to that, but I want to finish the overview here of why the Constitution was not, or what in the Constitution is designed to prevent representative democracy. So you said, or at least broad representative democracy. So you said that the state legislatures select senators, which certainly that's a small group of people selecting those so-called representatives. And then there's also the issue of the Electoral College. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Now, and of course, the 17th Amendment in 1913 gave us the right to elect our senators. But the Electoral College, you know, the people don't elect the president, right? The people elect representatives to the Electoral College, and the Electoral College chooses the president.
Right, and the electors don't necessarily, they're not bound.
Yeah. Tradition, sort of, anymore. If Oregon's representatives to the Electoral College voted differently than the people of Oregon did, there would be a lot of noise.
Has that ever happened, though? I mean, in the past?
It has, and I'm sorry, it's been a long time since I've researched it, but it has happened three times that the Electoral College has put somebody in office who did not win the popular vote.
Okay.
Or four times, actually. George Bush.
Well, but he was
the Supreme Court. Yeah, that's true.
Exactly. That was the Supreme Court, not the Electoral College. Yeah. And that's the other issue, is the way Supreme Court justices are selected has nothing to do with the will of the people, which may be which may not be a bad thing, actually. Because
It probably isn't. And one thing that I used to really be bummed out about, the fact that all these Supreme Court justices are 70 years old.
Uh-huh.
And they're living with a worldview that is out of date.
Right.
But as I've thought about it more and more, you know, if the ship of state moves too fast, it doesn't move smoothly, right?
Right, and I think that is the basic. Isn't that the basic idea behind conservatism? People who they don't necessarily fear change altogether, but they want to be cautious about how we change things.
Yeah, and. So the true revolutionary will be thinking of programs that appear to make gradual changes, but all of a sudden make major changes.
Yeah, that gets into a whole nother issue where we talk about people frame an issue so that it sounds like you're really conservative if you do this thing, when in fact these are radical changes.
Right, and so so that means, because just think about it, the forces of darkness, we'll call them that, are in charge. I mean, and they know how to run that operation. So if you try to attack them head on, they know what levers to pull.
Absolutely.
The only way you're going to beat them is if you come in on the side, mm-hmm. or if you sneak up on them.
Right, and we're gonna get into that. I mean, you have some really good ideas on that, and we mentioned one thing that people can do. It's kind of hard, and that's a constitutional amendment. We will get to that also later. That was you mentioned the constitutional amendment for direct vote. Took a huge movement, but it's possible, and it's been done a number of times by the people. So, okay, so we've sort of done an overview of some of the very basic reasons why we don't have a really representative government. We fixed one of those problems, sort of, by directly electing senators. You know, what's interesting to me is there are a lot of people who've adopted this idea of original intent and strict constructionism, who say that we should go back to letting our legislature select the senators, because that's what the founders intended, and apparently they were gods, or God was speaking to them.
Well, I mean, come on. The original federal constitution allowed slavery.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, original intent, no thank you. I think that's a stupid idea. And another thing that happened is that originally, the federal courts could not come in and rescue state citizens being abused by their state government.
Right.
Because they did not have jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So if the other side got control of the state government, they could abuse me however they wanted. They could say, you can't vote, you have to be a slave. You know, and the federal government, even if they had wanted to, couldn't have done anything about it.
Right, that's called tyranny of the minority.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be addressed in the Constitution, but they didn't do a very good job of that.
Yeah.
They were more afraid of tyranny of the majority, in other words, democracy.
Well, I don't know if they were afraid of democracy so much as the people who had lent money to finance the revolution were afraid that these poor farmers would say, oh, thanks for the money, but we're not going to pay you back.
Uh-huh.
And so they wanted to ensure that that didn't happen.
That's reasonable, but you know, that's only one issue. Unfortunately, it set a precedent, didn't it? That, and I believe in your paper here, you mentioned somebody explicitly said the primary purpose of the Constitution is to defend property, not rights.
Right, and that was a Supreme Court justice.
Right, so that is, you know, that's a lot of people would say that is at the core of the problem here, and why we don't have anything approaching a true representative democracy. Now, there are some other things in the original, before we dispense with original intent, that ridiculous idea, people also need to realize women couldn't vote, of course, and neither could people that didn't own property, in most states at least, I think all states originally, which meant that only about 10% of the people living in America.
And in some states, you had to believe in God.
You're right, right, there's that too, yeah.
God's okay with me, but, you know.
Well, it's generally considered, except by some religious fanatics, that's a basic principle of a democratic or a representative democracy. But, of course, like I said, there are some of these people who, these amateur lawyers who think they understand the Constitution better than trained people. Just because trained people disagree, they think they can believe whatever they want, and that makes sense. Well, anyway, you mentioned in this paper that, and this is the point I wanted to get back to, where you mentioned earlier, that there is a concern over excessive democracy. You've given one example, and that is that maybe the people who financed the Revolutionary War, including the banksters, most especially the banksters, actually, were concerned they wouldn't get paid back with interest or paid back at all. So there are other concerns, too, though, about excessive democracy, and I would disagree with you on one point. I think there were some of the founding fathers were quite clear. They were afraid, in a lot of ways, of rule by the mob, as Adams called it.
That's very true. I mean, you know, put the founding fathers in context. I mean, when the American Constitution was written, rule by the people or even for the people was largely untried.
Right. It was an Enlightenment idea, and this was the first place.
And, you know, and how wonderful for us that the people that we rebelled against were on the other side of the ocean. I mean, you think about it, you know, if you're in Germany and you defeat the powers that were, then you have to waste 25 years getting back at them. But we didn't have to do that because they were somewhere else.
Right.
We were able to concentrate on doing positive stuff. Well, from the corporation point of view. But,
right.
You know, and think about the time. The British to the north, the Spanish to the south, the French to the west, those Indians everywhere. You know, I mean, it was... things did not necessarily look like we were going to survive.
Which was the argument for a strong central government and not,
right.
not too much dilly-dallying with this democracy idea. You know, that's the same argument some people make now, these extremists who claim that we're in so much danger that too much democracy is a dangerous thing. So the people have to be kept in check. They can't be told the truth. They have to be spied on. The government has to have the right to invade their privacy and look at make unreasonable what used to be called unreasonable searches and seizures.
Right, and now those things are all that we get back to the idea of if the power was sufficiently divided, that wouldn't happen, right? Because those people wouldn't be able to gang up on it like that.
Right, and one of the ways that they did that was to check the power of the executive and give the war-making power to Congress. Unfortunately, Congress has simply given away that power to the executive, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think they have, and, you know, the war-making power, I never recovered from Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger threatening to send me to Vietnam and kill somebody I'd never met. That still seems wrong, but they had the power to do it.
Right, and they just assumed that power, and the problem was Congress didn't stand up. After the fact, they passed the War Powers Act, but that was crazy because all they were doing was reiterating what was clearly in the Constitution already.
Right, and you know, and this idea that Congress can, I mean, the War Powers is set out in the Constitution. Congress can't change the Constitution, but anyway.
Right, and that is we'll get into that. Of course, they can under Article 5, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah. They can send amendments out.
Right, they can't just pass a law and change the Constitution.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, I mean, think about it. Why in a country where the people are supposedly the ultimate sovereign, do I have to wait for Congress to tell me what I want in my Constitution? But anyway, all right.
Well, and people might think that's a crazy idea, but in fact, in most other countries that have changed their constitution at least in the last several decades, I don't know about before that, there is a popular vote when they change the constitution. It just seems like common sense. If you're going to claim that you're ruling by the consent of the governed, they should be give consent for any changes in the constitution, and they should be able to initiate that if they want.
That was my point.
Right.
That we can't, the only way we can amend the federal constitution is if Congress sends the amendment out to the several states.
Right. So
why
you
not
can.
Why not make that a two-way street?
Well, actually, that's not true. There are two ways to do it. The other way is through state legislatures. They can call for a convention
but that's never happened.
No, but they're working on it right now. They're working on it right now. And I'm not saying – let me just finish. My point is that what you're saying is it's not impossible, but it's very, very difficult. And the argument there is, well, you don't want to make those kind of changes very easy.
And I think that's true. But, you know, I mean, you don't want to make it hard. Easy to change the Constitution. And another, while we're talking Constitution, state constitutions are opposite of federal constitution.
Uh-huh.
Federal constitution is a grant of power. The federal government can only do what the federal constitution says it can. State constitutions are a limitation on power. The Oregon legislature can do whatever it wants unless the Oregon Constitution tells it that came. So those are two different kinds of documents.
That's a very interesting point I've never heard made. Thanks. Now, the problem with that, of course, is when state governments are given that much power, they will sometimes abuse the people, or conversely, the people will abuse the government. You give an example of Rhode Island, where the debtor class, after they got control of the government, the government under the Articles of Confederacy, they issued so much paper currency that Rhode Island money became almost worthless.
Right, and so Rhode Island wasn't invited to the Constitutional Convention.
Right? I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Well, now.
And, you know, also, Shades of Rebellion is another example.
Uh-huh.
You know, Massachusetts, because here, think of it, you know, all these farmers fought the revolution, and then they go home, and they don't have any money. And the banks say, pay us our mortgage. Oh, we don't have any money? Oh, okay, well then we'll just foreclose on you. So the farmers got upset about this, but the strong centralized government in Massachusetts was able to just summarily put it down.
Right.
George didn't even have to send in any troops, although he would have. George Washington was a jerk.
That's a matter of opinion. Let's not get sidetracked justifying that opinion. But he was certainly in favor of a strong central government. That's one reason that he promoted the Constitutional Convention. The whole idea of the Constitution was to create a strong central government that could do things that the government under the Articles of Confederation could never do.
Right, like levy taxes and build a strong military.
Right, although the argument won out that we shouldn't have a standing army, despite the threats. And unfortunately, boy, they sure threw that away, too. I wish these original intenters would focus on that a little bit and look at the cost of the military. We're spending, it's not a representative government, I should say, the current Congress just passed a budget with record spending for the military. It's like 11% increase, despite the fact that they passed this sequester act that was supposed to reduce it. Well, they reduced social services, but they didn't reduce that. So an argument could be made that, you know, these things maybe wouldn't have been so bad if the people had have assumed power and said, look, we fought this war. We deserve compensation. I'm sorry if you thought you were going to profit from the war, but no. You're paying us back because this is our government, and that's the kind of government we're going to set up, a government where everybody's taken care of. And everybody.
Well, also think about it. I mean, I don't know what percentage of the American population even knew how to read in 1776.
Right, true.
So, I mean, in college I learned that if majority of the Americans at the time had been able to read and knew what was in the Constitution, they wouldn't reject
it. It was a near thing anyway. If it hadn't been for Washington's advocacy, most people think it wouldn't have passed.
Anyway, it did.
It is. The rest is history. Well, you made the point that I wanted to get to next, and that is that Jefferson said, in order to preserve representative government, we must have an educated citizenry. He thought that was so important that when he died, he asked that the only thing that's inscribed on his tombstone was that he was the first president, or he was the founder and president of the University of Virginia, which was a public university, the first public university in the country. What if Jefferson's warning had been heeded and people would be taught their real history instead of the fictional history that we're taught in our classrooms? Do you think then that maybe people could have a more representative government and choose the way they want to run the economy and what the functions of government are instead of leaving it up to the people who benefit most from making the rules in such a way that they maintain their wealth, and or they, that is to say, they continue to accumulate wealth and maintain their power?
Well, I guess, but you know, you're talking about people being concerned about abstract stuff beyond, do I have the food I need for dinner? Am I making enough money to pay the rent? You know, those kind of things. I mean, I don't know what your situation is like, but I have to be lucky enough that I have generous parents who got rich. So I don't have to worry about that stuff. My father doesn't like that I take that approach, but, you know, but most people aren't that lucky. Most people have to scratch to stay alive.
Right. That's the way the people who designed the economic system want it. I mean, if you look at the range of possible economic systems, a lot of people are starting to realize now, in particular, as the middle class is getting wiped out, people are rethinking their assumptions about the way economies should work. And they're pointing out that, you know, if people were paid enough, we could eliminate unemployment, allow for earlier retirement, and give people a much higher standard of living.
Oh, sure. So it's the same. I mean,
by cutting hours, so they don't have to scratch.
And if, you know, if the timber companies had approached it correctly, we would still be having old growth timber for Oregon Mill if we hadn't spent 25 years sending our trees to Japan.
Right, but that's comparable. I was going to say that's something we can't reverse. I guess we could if we wanted to make a serious enough effort. But what I'm talking about is something so fundamental that it affects everybody. And if people who are scratching for a living can't make it because the rules are getting tilted more and more toward the wealthy, don't you think it's possible that we can people like you and I who do have this leisure can educate them? Because then they'll be willing to listen to alternatives, I would hope. I mean, do you think that's even possible? Because if it isn't, I don't see any hope for the United States or the world.
I guess I don't have too much faith in my fellow citizens. No, I mean, but you know, that may be a bit of cynicism on my part that's not deserved.
Well, I think it's very common attitude now because things have gotten so bad and people have allowed this to happen. And that comes to my other idea that might help deal with this issue of people can't rule themselves because they're too ignorant, whether they have an excuse or not, you know, whether they're too burdened by the vicissitudes of life and trying to scratch out a living in an unfair system tilted toward the rich or not. What if we had a required test of citizenship before you could vote, so that people who don't even understand how government's supposed to work don't get to participate in the decision making?
Well,
now that's undemocratic, but wouldn't it be pragmatic?
Well, I guess it would be pragmatic, but you know, the underlying that is the assumption that there are people who know the truth. Right? And that's a real stick. I find the truth a real elusive concept. You know, I mean, it's like when some right winger starts talking to me about absolutes. You know, I've got no problem with absolutes. Anybody who's paid any attention to why knows that there are things that are true and things that are false.
Right.
My problem is when somebody who isn't as smart as me and hasn't been trained in thinking like I have tries to tell me what the absolutes are. At that point, I just turn around and walk away. But, you know, that getting back to your idea about having a test of citizenship, I mean, the only problem with that is that the only person who could make that decision would be the government.
Well, that's true, but let's say now your big issue is initiatives. Let's say by initiative, the people got together and worked out what would be the fairest way of doing this. Say they could have people who are who have political science degrees, determining what the facts are, just the facts, not the opinions about the way things should be, just the facts, like a citizenship test that aliens have to take to get citizenship. I mean, most Americans, the vast majority of Americans, could not pass the citizenship test. We know this from polls they've taken about basic knowledge. 2/3 of Americans cannot name the three branches of government.
you know that test would end up looking like what they teach you at the League of Women Voters. Instead of teaching you the truth, I mean, or even if it had facts that were true, are they important? Because you wouldn't have anybody. I mean, one of the things, I have a journalism degree, right? And my mother taught me all my life that just simply understanding something, that doesn't mean anything. If you don't do something about it, you don't matter, you know? And journalism, as an institution, says that once we understand something, we're not going to do anything to make it happen. I mean, I just find that, I mean, so I'm glad I'm no longer a journalist.
Well, I would, okay, that's right, for journalists, but I think in general, I can cite you some examples, and we will get into this. Again, how do you pass a constitutional amendment if people can't get educated and organized to change things? Major changes, like giving women the right to vote. That took a lot of effort. And you detail in this paper how we got the right to directly elect senators. Another huge issue. Now, today there is a movement calling for a constitutional amendment that would abolish corporate personhood, another issue we're going to get to, the idea of corporate constitutional rights. And it would also declare that money is not speech. So therefore, it's not protected, that Congress can pass restrictions on how money is spent. And they have in the past that have been overruled by the Supreme Court. So I think that's one of the most important efforts we're making right now is to pass a constitutional amendment. It's been done, but unfortunately there's so much cynicism out there that it's not possible, despite the facts, the demonstrable facts of the contrary, that's what we're up against. So I hope that you will question some of your own cynicism and remember that we have made major changes, and hopefully it's not impossible at this point. I understand there's an argument that we can't do that anymore because we've become too dumbed down, but...
there is that, but we lost the money in politics battle about 25 years ago. When I first went to the University of Oregon in 1971, if I had wanted to be in the Oregon House of Representatives, I could have run a campaign for $2,000. You know, which in today's dollars would be about $10,000. I know enough people, I bet I could probably gather $10,000 if I worked hard.
Uh-huh.
But there's no way that I could gather $200,000 or $300,000. So people like me are by definition out of the process.
Well, I would grant you that we lost the battle, but then as somebody famously said, that doesn't mean we lost the war.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But I would say that the amendment that we need in federal constitution is a process that allows a closed amendment directly. Instead of this, you know, I mean, you read my stuff about how we got the 17th Amendment allowing for direct election of U.S. senators.
Right.
That took 45 years.
Right.
45 years. You don't have that kind of time. Think about if they had, if in 1910 or somewhere around 1915, if they had amended the federal constitution so that we could directly propose amendments to the federal constitution, how much easier what you're trying to do would be.
Now, what do you mean proposed directly? How would it differ from the current system where it takes two-thirds of the state legislatures to call for a constitutional convention before we can do it on our own?
Okay, well, again, that has never happened in the history of the country. And the reason that it happened, probably, is because nobody's sure whether we can direct that convention to adopt a certain amendment. In other words, once the convention is called, could they strengthen the Second Amendment? Could they take the First Amendment out of the Constitution? You know, and it has happened before. The original Georgia Constitution had an initiative clause, and a bunch of business people got together, called the Rump Convention, wrote the initiative out of the convention, and said, "This is the new Constitution." The Supreme Court of Georgia said, "We agree," and it was.
Why don't you explain to people what a rump convention is? I don't think most people know that term.
Okay, well, a rump is a organization that is not legitimate. That they came together. I mean, they just call the convention. The initiative clause in the original Georgia Constitution was that amendments to the Georgia Constitution could only be proposed by initiative petition. And a bunch of people got together, said, "Oh, they don't really mean that," and called a convention. So that a rump convention is just technically incorrect, but powerful nonetheless.
Okay, the reason I mention that is because depending on your definition of rump, you could say that the original constitutional convention for the federal constitution was a rump one because
of course it was
a small group of people got together and decided to write a new constitution. On the other hand, the Articles of Confederation, I don't think, said you couldn't do that or didn't specify another way of amending it. That was one of the problems with the articles. So.
Technically, the new constitution was approved, so it doesn't really matter what the. But have you ever read the Federalist Papers?
Not all of them. I've read excerpts and I've read a few of the individual papers.
You know, I have 3 degrees and I can barely read. I mean, people were educated, a lot more educated. You know, that occurred to me the other night. That's one of the problems with the democratization of high schools. You know, if you graduated from high school in 1880, you knew.
Yeah, but you know something? They also had town halls all through the country where people discussed the Articles of Confederation and these arguments, and the papers were full of these kind of discussions. So anybody that could read, you didn't even have to read because you can participate in these town halls. It's more a matter of, are you able to use critical thinking, and are you able to think about not only what's in your best interest, but what's in the country's best interest, because the Constitution is a government for the whole country? That's an open question, and arguably, I would say right now, people really have been too dumbed down to do that. It's a process, though. It's not something you do immediately.
I would start with the assumption that the only good government is one that allows me to help set the rules, no matter what my deficiencies are. You know, if I don't feel like I have an opportunity to help set the rules, I'm liable not to follow them. You know, I mean, people talk about John Locke. Have you heard of that name?
Oh yeah, you might want to tell our listeners
the founding fathers were big fans of John Locke, and John Locke, according to John Locke, revolution could never be justified. if you stayed in the country, even if you had no impact, no input into what the laws were, if you stayed in the country, you impliedly agreed to follow all laws. And you either followed the laws or you left the country. That was John Locke's approach.
That was also Muhammad's argument, interestingly.
Yeah. And, you know, and that was the kind of worldview that the fathers had.
That is interesting. You know, I've heard a lot of quotes from Locke and whatnot, but I've never heard that one.
Yeah. Well, you know, think about, John Locke was English. J.J. Rousseau, who was French, right? His one of my favorite Rousseau lines is, "Any law which the people have not ratified is invalid. It is not a law." They knew how to do government in France.
Yeah, that is radical.
They knew how to do revolution in France, too.
You know, that is another way that we could get around this problem of people being too ignorant. If they had to at least think about what the government is trying to pass and vote on it, we might stop some of the worst abuses. Unfortunately, things like the Patriot Act were popular, and wars are popular, and it's very easy to manipulate public opinion, which is what Plato said and why he argued that a democracy was not even possible.
Yeah.
Not one that worked, anyway. It always degenerates into a plutocracy, which is what we have here in the United States, according to that Princeton study that came out in the last year. The decisions that government makes rarely correspond with popular opinion anymore. When they differ from what the ruling class wants, the economic elite, the 1% or the 0.1%. There's a study where they looked at a whole, I don't know how many issues, a lot of different issues that were really important, and that's what they concluded. We are no longer a democracy, and I think Jimmy Carter seconded that and said, nope. If we ever were. So anyway, I wanted to get to the... to the idea, you keep mentioning the importance of the initiative, and maybe I would add the referendum is interesting too. But
yeah, a thought flashed in my mind. I have heard it, referendum where you can refer laws that the legislature has passed. I have heard it said that we ought to just take 5 laws every session and put them on the ballot. And if the people don't approve him, then everybody who voted for him is automatically recalled. Well, I think that's a great idea.
I think that's a little radical, but I do like the idea of every law being a referendum. I just wanted to mention that so people know what a referendum is, because not all states have them, and certainly they don't have them in other countries. So the legislature can refer bills, though, to the people to vote on, and unfortunately what they normally do is they do that when they don't want to get stung by voting the wrong way. That's about the only time they do it, and they won't do it when economic interests of wealthy people are at stake. I can't think of a single example where they've done that. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the initiative, the history of the initiative. Why don't you give us background on the history of the initiative?
Well, so about talking about the initiative, let's look at direct election of the U.S. Senate.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's just define initiative for people who live in states where they don't have that.
All right. The initiative is if I want to make a law, I get 85,000 of my friends sign a petition, and then that proposal goes on the ballot. If it's approved, then it's a law. 8% of people who voted in the last time a governor was elected to a 4-year term. About half the states have the initiative. Oregon was the first state to have it. Well, actually, South Dakota was the first state to adopt it. Oregon was the first state to use it.
Okay.
And so we get back to the idea of appointed as opposed to elected U.S. senators. The first attempt to make U.S. senators appointed was in 1824 when Andrew Jackson was in the Senate. He introduced a resolution sending the direct election amendment to the mini-state. The effort really heated up about 1870, 1875, somewhere in there. And there were state after state voted in a straw poll that we ought to have direct election of U.S. senators. More than three-quarters of the states then in the Union petitioned Congress for an amendment allowing for direct election. 10 states, including Oregon, called for a constitutional convention to write the direct election into the federal constitution. But in 5 times, the elected U.S. House voted to send the needed amendment to the state. The U.S. Senate would never debate it because they had a great thing going and they didn't want to ruin it.
Well, it's interesting, though, that you, I guess I didn't catch that when I was skimming through this when you said that there were so many calls from the states. You're talking about the state legislators, right? The ones that got to choose senators? They actually,
right.
Wow.
Right. So think about that. Think about that. Enough state legislators had petitioned Congress for direct election of U.S. senators to amend the federal constitution, yet they continued to send U.S. senators to Washington who blocked the idea.
So if they would have picked ones that supported the idea, then they could have gotten it passed.
Yeah. So I would argue that politics at its finest, because these legislators could then go home and say, look, I voted to support your drive for direct election to the U.S. Senate. But in secret, that keep it from happening. Oh, how ugly. Now, and also, think about what was happening. If I was in Indiana and found myself not part of the elite in my community, I could just move to Oregon, find some Indians, and steal their land, and then within 10 years, I would be part of the new, of the elite in my new community.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that kept the unfairness of the original federal constitution sort of at bay, because people could just move. But then we run into the Pacific Ocean, so there's no more places to go and steal the land. So Oregon adopted the initiative, borrowed the initiative from Switzerland, and it was approved 11-1. Think about that.
Wow.
It promised a huge change in government. Nobody knew what the result was going to be. We might have ended up worse off than we were before, but it was still approved 11-1. Boy, that says to me things really bad if people were willing to take that kind of time. So anyway, Oregon adopted the initiative in 1902, and then in 1907, used the initiative to become the first citizens in the country to elect their U.S. senators at the poll. So, with one state electing its senators, the old appointment system had no chance of surviving elsewhere, and within 5 years, the 17th Amendment spread direct election nationwide.
Wow.
So essentially, a bunch of well-educated Joes in Oregon City caused the amendment of the federal constitution. I find that an inspiring story.
Exactly. And that's the point I was making earlier, is I hope it will inspire people to work for the constitutional amendment that I talked about, or the one that you talked about.
Or one that anybody talked about.
Right.
I agree with you.
Either a national initiative or at least a reform of campaign finance, so we have more representative government. And I want to tell people there is an effort to do this. It is Move to Amend has adopted something called Pledge to Amend, which I've been talking about since 2010. They finally adopted it last year, a little bit late, in my opinion, to have an influence in the 2014 election. But one way that you can pressure your elected officials is to ask them in public whether they would support the Move to Amend pledge to pass a constitutional amendment that would abolish corporate constitutional rights, corporate personhood, and establish that money is not speech. You do not have a right to spend as much money as you want to elect the puppets of your choice, because then only the rich people have a voice. It's not freedom of speech just for the rich. It has nothing to do with speech, the ability to spend money on to buy puppet politicians. So people can get involved through Move to Amend. The reason I mention that is not because I understand that what you're saying, Greg, is also incredibly important. If we had a direct initiative process for the whole country, that would be awesome. By the way, Mike Gravel has been pushing that. The National Direct Initiative, NDI. I did a show on that. For people that are interested, they can go to our podcast files at SFPI Radio, stands for Soldiers for Peace International, and check that out. So there's a whole show on that. And Greg, if you haven't heard it, you might want to listen to Mike's ideas. But again, let me just say, people go to Move to Amend because there's already a movement behind that. That's one reason that I keep pushing so hard. Well, there's a movement. You know, we need to build that movement just like we did with direct election of senators and voting for women. And, you know, I'm sorry, Greg, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that I don't want national initiative for law. I think that's a bad idea. But I would like a national initiative for amending the Constitution.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well, that's great. But I do like your idea of a referendum for all laws, though. That's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, well, that was an original one for me. I thought that was a great idea.
Greg, I hate to cut you off because I just babbled on, but unfortunately, we're out of time.
Well, I've had a great time, and This is all such. I guess the final thing I would want to say is that, remember when there was the balanced budget thing happened?
Right.
There were enough states petitioned Congress for a constitutional convention, and they just ignored it.
Did you know, by the way, because there are people trying to get this Move to Amend style amendment passed through a constitutional convention, that Dan Marks in Hawaii just convinced the clerk of the court of the Senate, of Congress, clerk of Congress, to make a ruling about how they're going to count the votes. There never was one before that from the founding. That is count the number of petitions. Greg, we do have to go, though. Hopefully, maybe I'll have you back on. This was a great conversation.
Okay, good enough. Talk to you later.
Okay, that is it for Taking Back America for this week. Please join us next week.